This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Desert travel, archaeological digs, hieroglyphics, and ancient artifacts. That's what most people associate with Egyptology. As to whom we imagine pursuing the study of ancient Egypt, it's mostly men. But women made critical contributions to the field in its earliest days, despite male-dominated narratives that suggest otherwise. Kathleen Shepherd is a history professor at Missouri S&T and author of Women in the Valley of the King, the untold story of women Egyptologists in the Gilded Age. In the book, Kathleen showcases the stories of some of the earliest women who ventured to Egypt and whose work was forgotten or intentionally excluded from sources that form our current understanding of the who's who of Egyptology. St. Louis Public Radio's interim managing editor, Jonathan Aull, spoke with Kathleen to dig deeper on her research. Here's their conversation.
What was the impetus to write this book?
When I was doing my PhD dissertation, so I'm going to take you back like 15 years, I read Flinders Petrie. He was a big, great man in Egyptology. I read his autobiography, and in it, he mentioned one woman in half of a sentence. And he said, "My colleague, Miss Murray, came out to help us this season," or something like that. And I started wondering sort of, who is this person? And then once I looked into her, I realized she actually was not just his colleague. She worked with him for like 70 years. And she gave him an entire chapter in her autobiography where she got half a sentence in his. And so I started looking more into the women in Egyptology. And that was a really long time ago when it came time to sort of write a full history of Egyptology. The question was, how do you go about doing this, and who gets into the picture? And I realized that it had to be about these women because they were foundational to all of the other work that was happening, all of the other very visible work. This story must be told, and so here it is.
Unfortunately, Egyptology is not unique in the fact that women's contributions were marginalized or intentionally erased. But is there something special about the way women interacted with this intellectual discipline that you think might be a slightly different story than the way their contributions were marginalized in other fields?
Yeah, I really do. So because Egyptology professionalized so late compared to, say, mathematics or chemistry, Egyptology was professionalizing in the 1850s to the 1920s-ish, and I know that's like a long period of time. So as sort of the political and cultural and social landscapes were changing, women in Egyptology were actually allowed in pretty early on. In this professionalization process, either as travelers and writers or as patrons, early excavators like Maggie Benson. She was the first woman to get an official excavation permit in Egypt in 1895, which is really early, actually, for doing that work. So women were already sort of on the job, and they remained there. And if they had enough money, they could go and support their own excavations and make collections on their own. And most of the women in the book had quite a bit of money, especially the early ones. They usually had support of their father or their husband or some sort of male partner. But if they didn't, then they would find a woman partner to go along with them who was also wealthy and also wanted to travel. So it was all of these things together that were all sort of coming together in this perfect storm for women to be able to go, Egypt, like, let's freaking go. I want to get there. Let's see what there is to see.
You're very active on social media, and I couldn't help but notice that some of the things that you've put out there still kind of talk about a lot of the misogyny that's still present in academics in the United States today. Posts like, when you're the only woman in a faculty meeting, you have to be asked to take the minutes, as an example. How do you kind of reconcile with how far we've come and how far we have to go in terms of people getting equal credit for their intellectual abilities and pursuits, regardless of gender.
There was a study that came out, and I couldn't cite it. I would have to Google it, that said something along the lines of, at least in the United States, at the rate that we are moving, it's going to take us another 50 to 100 years to reach gender parity. And I think that it depends on the field that you're in, and it depends on maybe the institution that you're at. So like at Missouri S&T, where I am, it's a STEM-focused university. And so here, the gender ratio, if you're from Rolla or if you know anything about it, you know about the ratio, which is 3 men to every woman on campus. And that goes for both faculty and students. And so while there are efforts underway on campus, and I think there have been for a while, to make that ratio a bit better, a bit more equal, I think that we have a long way to go. And the only thing I think that we can do is be supportive of folks, you know, who want to come here and try to make the climate better for them and more welcoming and not as intimidating.
I'd like to go back to your book and have you read a portion of this. This is from the chapter on Kate Griffith and Emily Patterson. Mm-hmm. And you quote a letter that she wrote, that Kate Griffith wrote to a friend of hers, kind of struggling with the idea of domestic life and marriage and expectations mm-hmm. of women compared to the life that she wanted to lead. I'm wondering if you could just read that little excerpt and maybe tell us a little bit about it and kind of how it's a sign of a lot of the things that are in your book.
Yeah. I love these letters. She's writing to her American cousin, Jane, who she had never met in person, but she'd been writing to since she was like 9 years old. And when they were in their 20s, Jane actually was about – she was engaged. She was about to get married. And so Kate Bradbury wrote this to Jane. She was saying that, you know, she's not really against marriage. She wanted to live alone, but she wasn't against it. It just had to be the right kind. And so she said, "I agree with you. Women, as a rule, have narrower interests when married. Is it of necessity, I wonder? I am afraid so because of the children. Childless married life, a woman might make another thing. She might, but often she doesn't." I love this so much because before I found these letters, I had thought I had a very different idea of because she ended up marrying Frank Griffith, who had a huge crush on her from the time he met her. And it took a really long time for her to be convinced to marry him. And I thought it was because she possibly preferred same-sex relationships. I wasn't sure. She talked about how she was very happy working hand in hand with them. She said she was free to do nothing but work with him, which will be joyful. So she really found a true partner in Frank Griffith. And it really helped Frank out professionally because he didn't have a ton of money, but Kate was loaded. And so he basically, by the time, you know, that they got married and settled down, he was like free to just kind of write and think and do what he wanted right alongside Kate.
This is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jonathan Aul, and we're talking to Kate Shepherd. She's the author of Women in the Valley of the Kings, about women who are very crucial to the Egyptology movement of the early 1900s and into the 20th century. When you write about these women, their romantic relationships, mm-hmm. be it with men, husbands, mm-hmm. or in same-sex relationships, is part of the story. Did you feel any concern about making that part of the story because the intent is to profile their contributions? Mm-hmm. And how, to what extent did their personal lives, its relevancy mm-hmm. in how did you decide to include that?
Because I've been a biographer for 20 years, and I think that we lose a lot when we don't include the personal. And maybe it's because, you know, I'm a woman in a straight relationship, and so my domestic life carries over into my professional life, right? Like, I had a baby and I was then on leave after that, right? That's going to impact the work I'm able to do. And it does for men too, and it always has done. I mean, Darwin had 10 children. Did that impact his work? Yeah. Why are there not more biographers talking about that? Why in his seminal biographies is this not flowing throughout rather than just a mention here and there? Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so for me, it was a no-brainer. These women were impacted by their personal relationships, whether they carried them with them into the field or when they were working at home, the support that they received, and sometimes the stress that it caused was crucial to the work that they were doing.
You wrote that women were, in fact, the reason that any of the great men of Egyptology were able to be great at all.
Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe just elaborate a little bit on that?
As far as I know, this book, Women in the Valley of the Kings, is the first book that's a full sort of history of the discipline of Egyptology that really spotlights women. Most of the rest of them, I would say do what they can, but I don't think that they do. I think they really sort of forego women in favor of the men, because the work that the men do, you can't argue with it. It's exciting, right? They get dirty. Things happen. There's guns involved. People are getting in fights. Like, they're stealing. It seems very exciting. It seems very sort of Indiana Jonesy. But men were able to do those things because women were writing the letters. Hey, Flinders Petrie needs to go excavate. Kate Bradbury is writing letters for his permissions. Kate Bradbury is making sure that he has money in his account in Egypt so that he can pay people. Women are doing when the collections come back, they're unpacking them in the museum and they are writing the labels and they are doing all of that. But very often, men were much more interested in let's dig this out, let's do all of this, than they were about any of the domestic work that they needed women, their wives, their assistants to do.
I'm wondering if we can close with something that you wrote in your epilogue that I thought was kind of a good summation of a lot of what your book is all about. Could you read that for us and maybe expand on it a little
bit? Yeah. The worlds into which each of these women walked were very different from the worlds they left behind. In many ways, they dismantled parts of the discipline that would see them fail at worst and fade into the background at best. For a majority of these women, they not only benefited from these institutions that in the end erased them and Egyptians they worked beside, they also helped to strengthen their foundations. They left their marks when and where they could and changed the ways in which the discipline of Egyptology operated. Part of the goal here was to start, right, with Amelia Edwards and show how she sort of created, let's say, a step onto which then Emma Andrews could step on. And then, you know, Maggie Benson and Nettie Gourlay and Emma Andrews. And then after Emma Andrews, you know, you get Margaret Murray, who comes in and she's like, I don't have a ton of money, but I'm going to go and I'm going to do this work in the field. And the same for Amos Calverley and Myrtle Broom, right? And so all of these women created a step that the next generation could stand on, if you will, to quote Newton, right, or paraphrase Isaac Newton, who said he stood on the shoulders of giants. I think that's really what I tried to do, was to show that these women were standing on each other's shoulders and just able to lift the other women up, which is what we should be doing anyway.
This episode was produced and recorded by Jonathan All and edited by Ola Kuziz.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.